Hello, this is Rita from the Talk and Information Center. It's Tuesday, February 17th. The Washington Post. Popular anger burns in Iran after crackdown as Trump turns up pressure. As the Trump administration heads into nuclear talks with Tehran, after a government crackdown killed thousands, widespread outage has not abated, Iranians say. By Susanna George. As Iran heads into its second round of nuclear talks with the United States in Geneva on Tuesday, under the threat of U.S. forces building up in the region, Tehran is attempting to project strength and unity, but seething popular anger has not been abated in the weeks following a government crackdown that kills thousands of protesters, according to accounts from inside the country. Following the partial rollback of government-imposed communications blackout that closed off Iran during the protests and crackdown down last month, more information has begun to circulate. Iranians described to the Washington Post a society deeply traumatized, with many people saying they only recently learned the full extent of the violence, as security forces continue to carry out waves of arrest. But some analysts say Iran's unprecedented weakness at home could diminish the flexibility of its country's leadership to make the kinds of compromises necessary for a deal. Iran remains a nation in shock. The government crackdown left more than 7,000 people dead, more than 6,500 of them protesters, according to Human Rights Activists News Agency, a U.S.-based advocacy organization for the rights in Iran. The figures are expected to climb. Thousands are missing and families are still in mourning. A campaign of arrests continues. Some businesses have reopened and schools are back in session, but many parents report keeping their children at home. Some of us don't work because we're still grieving, but some of us cannot work because there are no reliable prices, said a Tehran shopkeeper, 40. Inflation has skyrocketed since the crackdown, and with the added threat of U.S. strikes, no one wants to spend any money, he said. He has been increasing the prices of goods in his shop almost daily. Like others in Iran interviewed for this article, he spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of retaliation. Iranian authorities have arrested tens of thousands of people since last month, according to activists and human rights groups. The campaign has expanded to include prominent political leaders. Azar Mazori, head of the Reform Front of Iran, was arrested last week and released on the bail days later. In some areas, security forces screen people on streets and in businesses for evidence they supported the protests. A 45-year-old woman from Ras, near Iran's Caspian Sea coast, said, "Security forces showed up at her niece's school and strip-searched students for wounds sustained at protests from the less lethal pellet ammunition fired into the crowds. Two girls fainted from the stress," she said. Her niece hasn't been back to the private school since, which the principal has allowed. But at some public schools, a woman from Rash said, absences aren't tolerated and students found with pellet wounds are expelled or arrested. In other parts of the country, popular anger is bubbling to the surface. Chants of death to Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, can be heard at some funerals for those killed during the protests, according to recent videos shared with the Post. Similar calls ran out in Tehran. "Murderous Khamenei, see it in your dreams," people yelled from their apartment windows last week, using a dismissive Farsi expression now associated with the January protests. While the crackdown had occurred weeks ago, many Iranians say they are only now coming to terms with its scale. A woman from Bandar Abbas on the Persian Gulf, who says she participated in the protests, said she saw security forces open fire into the crowds. "The bullets wouldn't pause for a second," she said. As she was running away, someone running behind her was shot and fell to the ground. But even after what she saw, she wasn't prepared for what she learned of the scale of the killings once internet connectivity was partially restored. "Seeing the mass killings all over the country felt like waking up from a deep sleep with a slap on my face. I am ashamed to be alive," she said. I am also full of rage. Before January, she would not have understood why people would want their own country to be attacked, she said, as the threat of U.S. strikes loomed. But this time it is different, she said, espousing a view long unpopular in Iran. The real enemy is the Islamic Republic, and any country or army that can weaken or attack them is going to liberate us. When Iranian officials do address the January protests, they blame the violence on terrorist groups linked to outside countries. Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian spoke last week to families of people killed. "We are embarrassed because of what has happened in this country," he said in an even tone to men and women dressed in black, sitting in sterile meeting rooms. Pezeshkian pledged to help those who lost loved ones. "As someone who has a responsibility to this country, sometimes I cannot even sleep thinking about it. What happened?" he said. Iran used overwhelming force against the protesters to clear people out of the streets, but to also buy the government time by preventing any future waves of unrest, said Alex Vedanka, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, a Washington think tank. "They didn't mind the optics. In fact, they wanted to show how ruthless they were," he said. "Right now, they want society to be scared. They don't care about the reputational cost. It's about survival." That could complicate negotiations with the U.S. over Iran's nuclear program. Public comments by Iranian and U.S. officials in recent days have ranged from optimism that a deal could be reached to threats of military action. Late last week, President Donald Trump said he was sending a second aircraft carrier group to the Middle East and said that regime change was the best thing that could happen in Iran. "If Tehran wanted to avoid an attack," he said, "it should give us a deal that they should have given us the first time," referring to talks last summer that ended when the U.S. and Israel launched air attacks on Iran's nuclear sites. But Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters during a visit Sunday to Slovakia, the president made clear he prefers diplomacy and an outcome of negotiated settlement. He said U.S. negotiators Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner were headed for important meetings and will see how that turns out. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Majid Takht Ravanchi told the BBC in a Sunday interview that the ball was in America's court to prove that they want to do a deal, adding that, "If they are sincere, I'm sure we will be on the road to an agreement." Tasha Ravanchi said an Iranian offer to dilute its highly enriched uranium was proof of its willingness to compromise, and he did not rule out an agreement to ship its stockpile out of the country, saying it was too early to say what will happen in the course of negotiations. Robert Marley, a former U.S. official who negotiated with Iran on the nuclear issue under President Joe Biden, said the talks are less likely to succeed if the Trump administration asks for concessions like curbs to Iran's ballistic missile program or the end of the support for armed groups in the region. A widening of scope Tehran has long rejected. "Those are concessions Tehran's weakened regime will not make, especially because it is weakened and thus can't afford to give up the few remaining tools at its disposal," he said. While Iran's proxy network is significantly diminished after the war in Gaza, Israel blows against Hezbollah in Lebanon and the end of Bashar al-Assad's rule in Syria. Iran's missile program remains its only form of deterrence, he said. Rubio lends hand in Hungary's Orbán as he faces tough election. "We want this country to do well," Marco Rubio said during a visit to Budapest, "especially as long as you're prime minister." Excuse me, I'm having a little bit of trouble here. By John Hudson. Budapest. Secretary of State Marco Rubio sought to throw Viktor Orban a political lifeline on Monday as the Hungarian Prime Minister trails in most polls ahead of an election this spring that could see Europe's most pro-Russia and longest ruling prime minister, voted out of power. The top US diplomat praised Orban's leadership, signed a civilian nuclear cooperation agreement with his government, and defended issuing Hungary an exemption from US sanctions despite Orban's decision to continue buying Russian energy. "We want this country to do well," said Rubio, standing alongside Orban during a news conference in Budapest, "especially as long as you're the prime minister and the leader of this country." "President Trump is deeply committed to your success because your success is our success," Rubio added. Rubio's support for Orban marks the latest example of the Trump administration working to keep in power right-wing populist leaders who have praised President Donald Trump and are seen as ideologically aligned. In summer, political neophyte Karol Nawrocki narrowly won a presidential runoff in Poland after being invited to the White House by Trump. In a post on Truth Social last week, Trump endorsed Orban for the April elections and called him a strongly and powerful leader and a true friend, fighter and winner. Whether the efforts by Trump and Rubio will help Orban prevail in the election remains far from clear, in part because Orban's opponent, Peter Megyer, is also conservative as it has gained traction with an anti-corruption message. Most polling show Megyer's party with significant lead, was standing on the threshold of victory with 56 days left to go, Megyer said Sunday, as he formally launched his party's election campaign in Budapest, vowing to crack down on corruption, return Hungary to its Western European orientation, and end Orban's nearly 16-year reign. Megyer took control of the centre-right TISA party in 2024, the same year the party won about 30% of the vote in European parliamentary elections. Before he pivoted to the centre, he belonged to Orban's Fidesz party. Orban and his Fidesz party are considered by growing a cohort of US conservatives as the intellectual vanguard of policies they seek to replicate in the United States, including hardline immigration policies and Christian nationalism. US conservatives have praised Orban for establishing a fence on Hungary's southern border in 2015 to keep out refugees fleeing from the Middle East and Africa. They have also praised him for cracking down on LGBTQ plus rights, such as banning the Budapest Pride celebration and approving facial recognition technology to identify scoff laws of the ban. Hungary regularly plays host to US conservatives at its Conservative Political Action Convention conference events, which will again convene in March. Orban and the Prime Minister of neighbouring Slovakia, whom Rubio visited on Sunday, are lonely voices in Europe in offering enthusiastic praise for Trump, who has angered traditional US allies by imposing tariffs on them, threatening to take Greenland by force, and attacking European digital regulations. Both Hungary and Slovakia have hailed Trump's efforts to engage Russia and have expressed skepticism about the Western support for Ukraine. Orban underscored that point on Monday using the same hypothetical scenario Trump routinely brings up in his own remarks. "If Donald Trump had been president of the United States, this war would not have ever broken out," Orban said. "If he were not the president now, then we would not even stand the chance to put an end to the war." Rubio expressed aspiration that Washington's efforts, criticizing some parts of Europe for prioritizing Moscow's demands over Kyiv, weren't being held more widely. "This is one of the few wars I've ever seen where people in the international community condemn you for trying to help end a war. But that's what we're going to do as long as our role and engagement is a positive one," Rubio said. Orban also thanked the Trump administration for allowing Hungary to continue purchasing cheap energy from Russia despite significant efforts by the European Union to stop purchasing Russian oil and gas following the country's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Critics of Trump's rapprochement with Hungary question how it serves U.S. interests. Hungary now buys a greater percentage of oil, its oil from Russia than it did at the start of the invasion, said Jeff Reck, the president of American German Institute and a former State Department official. So it is unclear how Uban contributes to any U.S. objectives aside from the ideological project of supporting right-wing, anti-European, would-be autocrats. When asked about Hungary's deepening business ties with China and Russia, Rubio said it shouldn't surprise anyone that Budapest is pursuing its own national interests and emphasized the importance of Uban's personal relationship with Trump. I'm going to be very blunt with you, Rubio said. The Prime Minister and the President have a very, very close personal relationship and working relationship, and I think it's been incredibly beneficial to the relationship between our two countries. Us versus them, the battle that's tearing a small Virginia town apart. We are the microcosm of how politics are in this country right now, said one resident of Percival. By Paul Schwarzenman. The town council meeting had reached the point on the agenda where the public could speak on any topic, and emotions, it put it mildly, were a tad raw. It's not too late to resign, a woman shouted at the lawmakers, four of whom, including the mayor, are the focus of a recall campaign. Stop screwing our town, a man railed. We are broken sicker of you than ever, someone else yelled. Small towns often are known for their quirky, insular intrigue, but the drama unfolding in Percival, a Virginian exurb that's a 50-mile drive west of Washington, is a brass-knuckled version of quaint. The battle is rooted in tensions that often divide communities across the country. Change versus status quo, growth versus no growth. Only in Percival, the weapons are lawsuits, an attempted citizen revolt, and the kind of ferocious rhetoric that defines much of public life in contemporary America. Residents could be forgiven for needing a whiteboard to chart the dizzying developments. Over the past year, state police accused the vice mayor and town manager of orchestrating a bid rigging scheme, charges both men deny. The vice mayor has filed a $42 million lawsuit against a gaggle of town and law enforcement officials, alleging his rights have been violated. The interim police chief has filed a $20 million defamation lawsuit against the vice mayor. Then there are more than 1,100 residents who signed petitions seeking to recall the mayor, vice mayor, and two council members, a campaign that has caught the attention of state lawmakers in Richmond who are weighing whether to intervene. The civic discourse has grown so uncivil that a police officer stands guard by the dais during council meeting, as was the case Tuesday. The meeting went on for more than 5 hours and drew a crowd large enough to fill town hall, including some who bought bags of popcorn to snack on. More than 1,000 people watched online. We are a microcosm of how politics are in this country right now, said Josh Shields, 47, who has lived in Percival since 2016. Nobody is willing to meet in the middle. Nobody is willing to discuss issues. It's us versus them. A town council meeting should be like watching paint dry. Instead, it's a dumpster fire. Shields added to the theatrics at the meeting when he shouted at the lawmakers after the audience was warned that outbursts could mean being asked to leave. Christopher Bertort, Percival's mayor, furrowed his brow and ordered Shields to escort himself out. As Shields departed, the mayor could be heard saying, "Jackass," under his breath. A hot mic moment caught on video that someone shared with 5,600 followers on Percival's centric Facebook page. Mayoraby versus Metropolis. The council to-do list that night included deciding whether to reappoint a vice mayor, the man at the center of the maelstrom. Carl Bennett, a council member whose official biography says he has worked for the U.S. Secret Service and a contract CIA intelligence officer. Net 51 gained the measure of national attention in Kentucky in 2019 when, as a candidate for Secretary of State, he unsuccessfully tried to add Trump, including the exclamation point, as his middle name on the ballot. At another point, he deleted a tweet suggesting he wanted to use a Democratic congressman for target practice. Net, who apologized for what he described as my attempt to be clever, received 13% of the vote in the GOP primary and finished fourth. After buying a home in Percival in 2021, Net joined the town's police force and, while still a patrol officer, ran for council seat in 2024. He aligned himself with a slate of candidates who called themselves Team Mayberry, a reference to the Andy Griffith Show, that the 1960s sitcom about a sheriff and his son, Opie. Team Mayberry tooted itself as a defender of Percival's small-town identity and tagged its opponents as Team Metropolis, advocates of city slicker-style development and higher taxes and utility rates. Net's team won, after which Percival's raft of troubles and his own exploded in public view. First in April, the police terminated him over the allegations that he had improperly used sick time. Then in July, a grand jury indicted Net and then town manager Kwasi Frazer for allegedly conspiring to steer a $12,000 contract to access the police department to a consultant with whom they had discussed the work before soliciting bids. Net, in a memo to the consultant, laid out a restructuring plan for the department that included the vice mayor becoming police chief. Net and Frazer, who are awaiting trial, have each pleaded not guilty to two felony counts of bid rigging and commercial fraud. Net faces four additional charges for allegedly using his position as a police officer to improperly obtain information from a database about two political opponents. Frazer, reached by phone, called the case against him laughable and said he is being defamed and slandered every day in the court of public opinion. Referring to his meeting with the consultant before seeking bids, Frazer said his position as town manager allowed him to meet with anyone prior to procurement decision. "I'm ready to take this court so the truth can prevail," he said. Net, in an interview, said the allegations, as well as his firing, are part of a coordinated campaign to deprive him of his right to due process and ruin his political career. His lawsuit alleges that those behind the effort to damage him include several of his council colleagues, as well as Percival's interim police chief and Loudoun County's chief prosecutor. "I'm not a bad guy in this," Net said. "I'm the victim." Khalib Stote, a council member who is among those named as defendants in the vice mayor's lawsuit, said Net's claims defy reason and have made an already toxic situation much, much worse. The centre of Percival, by all appearances, could be a postcard from Arthur era. Nichols Hardware, opened in 1914, is still the same location across from an American Legion Hall on a stretch lined with century-old building bricks. Brick buildings, a smattering of shops and restaurants, and a gazebo furnished with four green Adirondack chairs. "It's an American dream," said Ron Rice, 69, a retired aerospace executive and a town resident since 1988. "You know that a little girl in Miracle on the 34th Street, what did she want? A little house in a place like Percival. And now I feel so sad for this town," Rice said. "I hate it. It's just so awful." Percival's population began swelling a generation ago from 3,500 to about 9,000 as developers poured into Loudoun County, propelled by the tech boom that brought data centers, shopping centers, and subdivisions that made the region among the country's most rapidly changing. "We have sixth-generation farmers and are fresh off the beltway transplants," photographed Becky Gardner told the council last week. "We have horses, hemp, and hybrids, FUVs. We have a small business owners, homeschooling parents, federal employees, retirees, developers, preservationists." As Percival's population grew, a rift emerged over how to oversee the town's growth, the tension manifesting in battles over land annexation and proposal to raise utility rates and build roads intended to ease traffic. and his allies won their 2024 races and gained majority control of the council after promoting their ticket with the slogan, Maybury, not Metropolis. They promised to cut utility rates and maintain Percival's small town feel, no six-story buildings, as Net wrote in the Blue Ridge Leader, a news outlet that his foes allege seeks to bolster Team Maybury. Valerie Curry, the Leader's publisher, wrote in a December opinion article that the town is divided between a majority fulfilling the will of the voters and a very well-connected political minority determined to reverse the outcome of an election. The headline, View from the Ridge, Percival isn't corrupt, is being sabotaged, Curry declined to be interviewed. Beverly Cheeseson, 72, a third-generation Percival resident and a former council member, understands the appeal of Team Maybury's anti-growth message, even as she also knows change is inevitable. I would have loved to keep my little town, she said, but I knew that wasn't an option. The council infighting began almost immediately after Net and his allies took office 13 months ago. Without warning or discussion, the new majority voted to fire the town manager and install Fraser, Percival's former mayor. The three dissenting council members, Erin Rayner, Kevin Wright and Stoat, accused Team Maybury of operating in secret to impose its agenda, a near-constant refrain when the Maybury majority wins votes by a 4-3 margin. The Machine Nations prompted residents to take the extraordinary step of organising the petition drive to recall Net and Bertort, along with a council member Susan Kalil and Carol Luke, the other Team Maybury members. Every single meeting, they were coming in and ramming something through, said Brian Morgan, 61, the recall campaign's organizer. They don't respond to emails. It was audacious. It was a lack of transparency. Nat said the last election proved that most Percival residents support the Maybury majority and predicted the recall effort will fail when it comes to court in March. Betraut, Cahill and Luke declined to be interviewed. The fireworks became louder in April after the town's interim police chief, Sarah Lobrana, fired Net. Less than a week later, Net and his council allies, again without warning, signalled that they'd seek to disband the police department, provoking enough of a public outcry that the lawmakers subsequently rejected the idea. The sequence of events prompted Loudoun's county's chief prosecutor, Bob Anderson, to allege that Net, in what Anderson described as a blatant conflict of interest, appeared to have used his council seat to retaliate against the police for his firing. Net counters that eliminating the police would save the town money. By then, Anderson has placed Net on a list of cops deemed unreliable to testify in court, a designation that effectively strips police officers of their power. A grievance panel eventually reversed Net's termination, but a special prosecutor, Eric Olson, nullified that decision, contending that the panel had not followed state and local law. Then in July, state police announced the arrest of Net and Fraser, and Percival once again generated the headlines that made it a topic of chatter well beyond its borders. The other day, a guy I know in Ohio called me and said, "Why is your town on the news?" said Dale Thompson, 58, who owns a Main Street gun shop. "I don't want to be on the news for some scandal all the time. It's embarrassing." The saga also had brought residents together in its unexpected ways, whether it's rallying around the recall campaign or meeting up to attend council sessions and court hearings. Christina Buffington, a local entrepreneur, said she was inspired to start a website, Percival News, to track developments. "The chaos of the past," she said, "has caused her anxiety that she tries to manage by thinking of each council meeting as an episode of a reality TV. You'll have to find the humour in it," she said, "or it will make you crazy." The council meeting was well past its second hour last week when a member of Team Maybury nominated Net for another one-year term as vice mayor. Laughter could be heard in the audience. Net has neither the temperament, the personality, nor the character to serve as his town's vice mayor, Stort said when the mayor opened the floor to discussion. The crowd applauded. After everything Mr. Net has been through, he knows the role very well and he has shown he can deal with it, Luke said when it was her turn. The council approved Net's reappointment by a 4-3 vote, as expected. Why is the biggest campaign buzzword tapped into a broader political hunger? Essential costs such as housing and food keep getting more expensive and wages haven't kept up. By Julie Z. Wheel. Affordability is a political word of the moment. The prices of everyday essentials, such as housing and healthcare, are at the top of Americans' concerns. And affordability has become many politicians' favorite term to refer to the issue, rather than the older buzzwords such as cost of living, the more basic prices, or specific economic measures such as inflation. Affordability rocketed up in Google Trends in November when Democrats Abigail Spanberger, Mickey Sherrill, and Saran Madami all won elections as governor of Virginia, governor of New Jersey, and mayor of New York City, respectively. In part on the strength of campaigns that centered on the word, the New York Times noted that email-led newsletters from members of Congress almost never used the word before Joe Biden's presidency and used it fewer than 10 times a month before President Donald Trump's second term. In November and December, they mentioned it is 70 times a month. Why this word and why now? The term speaks to an uncomfortable gap between certain key costs such as housing and people's income. With inflation much cooler than its sky-high 2022 peak of 9% on Friday, the latest report showed annual inflation at 2.4%. Affordability speaks to people's ongoing complaints about costs without referencing economic benchmarks. Trump won the presidency in part because of a surge in prices during the Biden administration and promised to bring down prices, but he has downplayed discussions about affordability, pointing to stock market gains that have boosted 401ks and other positive economic signs. Of course, concerns about high prices have shaped politics before, but the term affordability is particularly buzzing now. While the verb afford dates back to the Old English according to the Oxford English Dictionary, and the adjective affordable appeared in 1647. Affordability is a relatively new term, possibly coined in 1910 in an article in the Indianapolis Star. Affordability was scarcely used with the 1950s, according to the dictionary. Google's Negram viewer shows that the term started appearing more and more often in books from the mid-70s to the mid-90s. Before the affordability moment, the word affordable took on political connotations through its associations with state-subsidized affordable housing and then the 2010 Affordable Care Act that reshaped healthcare policy under President Barack Obama. Just before the coronavirus pandemic, journalist Annie Lowry wrote a piece headlined The Great Affordability Crisis Breaking America. She argued that positive numbers about the economy, unemployment down, wages up, mask the hardships caused by rising prices. A year later, pollster Jeff Gurin pushed Democrats to talk about affordability, arguing that Biden's habit of talking about jobs created wasn't resonating with voters who would rather hear about how the government could bring down prices, whether they were employed or not. Voters worried about the cost of healthcare, childcare, and more, Gurin argued. Gurin looks back at a presentation he gave to Senate Democrats' campaign committee in 2021 that had the word affordability in bold at the top of a slide. The word's important, because it speaks to the real world challenge that Americans feel. It's hard for them to afford the things that they consider essential to a middle-class standard of living, he said. Garin credits the activist group groundwork with pushing the shift from Biden's emphasis on new jobs to Democrats' current focus on bringing down costs. Congress passed legislation early in Biden's term that flooded the economy with money, a move that helped the U.S. rebound quickly from pandemic, but many economists said contributed to higher inflation. Trump beat Democrat Kamala Harris in 2024 with a message focused on the problem of high prices and a vow to reduce the cost of groceries on one day. By October of last year, economic thought leaders were working to reclaim the term. The Less Lean in Economic Security Project published its affordability framework, and the Urban Institute launched an American affordability tracker. In November, after the election victories by the Democrats who ran on affordability, Groundwork published an Affordability for All agenda of 10 policy ideas. The affordability agendas keep coming. Just this month, the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus and the New Democratic Coalition in Congress launched them too. The New Democratic Socialist Mayor of New York, who promised to freeze some tenants' rent and make bus rides and daycare for two-year-olds free, is perhaps the most prominent affordability politician. But even he didn't use the word much before the summer. Andrew Epstein, who was Madami's communications director during his primary campaign, personally favored the term cost of living over affordability, which he says he viewed as clunky. When Madami announced the candidacy, he said the city was unlivable for the working class, calling it a quiet, grinding crisis. But he didn't use the word affordability in that speech and rarely used it en route to his win in the Democratic primary. In Madami's general election campaign against then-Mayor Eric Adams and former Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, however, affordability became his catchword. "I lost the argument in the campaign," Epstein said, laughing. "We feel very gratified that we identified and ran at something which clearly tapped into a broader political hunger in the country." Jeffrey Lerner, a longtime Democratic operative who became Madami's communications director for the general election, likes the term. "We can talk about prices going up and people being paid more, but the truth is, for most Americans, the math doesn't matter. You just can't make the budget add up week after week. Affordability captured that in the way of the cost of living or inflation or wage gains doesn't," Lerner said. "More and more Americans, not just working poor, not just single parents, not just new immigrants, even middle class, upper middle class people, are getting to a place where they cannot afford what they could 5 to 10 years ago." Today, Republican voters are even more concerned about the problem than Democrats. In YouGov polling this month, 31% of Republicans said that inflation or prices are the single most important problem in America right now, compared with 23% of Democrats and 21% of independents. For every age group, inflation or prices are the top concern. But while Democrats have embraced the word affordability, Trump has called it a hoax and a fake word by Democrats. In an email, Republican National Committee spokeswoman Kirsten Pelz pointed to Trump's deals with pharmaceutical companies on drug prices and sweeping tax cuts that reduce taxes for most households. Democrats claiming to be party of affordability is pure gaslighting, Pelz said. Their policies delivered skyrocketing grocery bills, outrageous gas prices, and the worst inflation in 40 years, crushing working families. President Trump is cleaning up the Biden-era economic wreckage, driving prices down, lowering mortgage rates, and restoring affordability where Democrats failed. Tim Hogan, who runs the Democratic National Committee's War Room, which pushes out political messages each day, said that a string of election wins since the presidential loss in 2024 have shown Democrats the power of running on bringing down prices, including a state senator who flipped a seat in Iowa in August while talking about childcare and housing, and two Georgia candidates who flipped seats in the November in a state election that hinged on utility prices. Food is more expensive, mortgage delinquencies are going up, credit card is climbing, this sticker shock Colin has said with affordability, Hogan said. Affordability is shorthand for our understanding that things are getting harder. The very real concrete lived experience is people are going to the grocery store, trying to heat their homes and seeing that their paychecks aren't keeping up. Senior Mary McKernan, an economist who guided the creation of Urban Institute's affordability agenda, said the word works better than many terms because it covers not just prices, but also whether workers' earnings are high enough to pay costs. We've had something of an economic conundrum for a while, McKernan said. On the one hand, we've had a consistent GDP growth and stock markets increasing since 2022. Inflation is down below 3%, and yet the overwhelming economic experience for most Americans is this sense of unaffordability or inability to get ahead. People want what they're experiencing validated. McKernan's answer to that puzzle is that the essential costs have risen faster than inflation and more quickly than people's wages. Her tracker shows the wages have risen 38% since 2017, but childcare costs have gone up 40%, health insurance 41%, rent 50%, and home sales prices 80%. Mike Causal, who co-wrote the Economic Security Project paper, recently charted how four key expenses, groceries, housing, healthcare, and transportation, have eaten up a larger fraction of American spending in recent years, leaving people feeling squeezed even on supposedly good economic conditions. I think affordability speaks to that security of life being a little further out of reach, he said. It also helps pull together a lot of different things, from people's access to healthcare to access to a home, all very different phenomena that has gotten more expensive. There's a little less left over to enjoy things. Robert Duvall, chameleon of the silver screen, dies at 95. In The Godfather and Apocalypse Now, he became one of the most respected acting talents of his generation. By Adam Burstein. Robert Duvall, an Oscar-winning actor who disappeared into an astonished range of roles, lawmen and outlaws, southern-fried alcoholics, and Manhattan boardroom sharks, a hot-headed veteran and a cool-tempered mod consigliere, and emerged as one of the most respected screen talents of his generation, died February 15th. He was 95. His wife, Luciana Pedrazes Duval, said in a Facebook post that Mr. Duval died at home without citing a cause. He had long lived at Burley, a horse farm in Fauquier County, Virginia, near the plains. By his own account, Mr. Duval was a late-blooming youth, a Navy Rear Admiral's son, whose only discernible talent in childhood was for meticulous mimicry. His repertoire included Western ranches and the military brass, and his stage was the dinner table. Metrothoris became a hallmark of his career. Newsweek film critic David Anson once called Mr. Duvall a character actor who approaches each role with the diligence of an ethnologist on field trip into the soul. Without matinee idols looks, he had a sinewy frame, colorine blue eyes, a slightly bent nose, and sandy brown hair slicked back on either side of his balding pate. He seemed designed to portray taciturn outsiders, macho oddballs, and rugged eccentrics. Mr. Duvall was a near-constant presence on screen, beginning with his movie debut as a ghostly, feeble-minded Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird 1962, based on Harper Lee novel. Over the next half-century, he had a few top-billed parts, notably his Academy Award-winning turn as an alcoholic country-western singer in Tender Mercies, 1983. He performed the song so authentically with his lived-in tenor that he was invited to record an album in Nashville with veteran music producer Chips Moman. Mr. Duvall received Oscar nominations for his starring roles as Trianical, hyper-competitive military father in The Great Satani, 1979, based on the Pat Conroy novel, and as a fallen Pentecostal preacher seeking grace in The Apostle, 1997, which he also wrote and directed. But in a career spanning about 140 film and TV credits, Mr. Duvall's prime turf was a supporting role. The personality carries a movie, not someone like me, he told the Chicago Tribune. But the star may have meteoric park, and there I am in the second or third lead, quietly doing quality things. No two films showcase the spectrum of those quality things more than The Godfather, 1972, and Apocalypse Now, 1979, both critical and cultural juggernauts directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and for which Mr. Duvall earned Oscar nominations for supporting work. In the first, he portrayed Tom Hagen, the discreet mob lawyer and the informal foster son of Corleone's family, whose patriarch was played by Marlon Brando. Film scholar David Thompson called Mr. Duvall's Hagen a role he reprised in the 1974 sequel, A Detailed Study and a Self-Effacing Man, one willing to suffer humiliation to earn his place as a non-Italian among Italians. In Apocalypse Now, an epic film about war and madness set in Vietnam, Mr. Duvall played Gilgore, the surfing-obsessed lieutenant colonel who declares in one of the movie's oft-quoted lines that he loves the smell of napalm in the morning. Instead of devolving into crackpot flamboyance, Mr. Duvall delivered, in the description of New York Times critic Vincent Canby, a performance of breathtaking force and charm. Canby called Mr. Duvall one of the most resourceful, most technically proficient, most remarkable actors in America, likening him to Laurence Olivier in his sharp, shape-shifting prowess. Mr. Duvall was convincingly British Dr. Watson to Nicole Williamson's Sherlock Holmes in The 7% Solution, 1976, an eye-patch-sporting Nazi colonel who masterminds a plot to kidnap Winston Churchill in The Eagle Has Landed, 1976, a hard-boiled Los Angeles police detective in True Confessions, 1981, and an aging Cuban emigre in Wrestling Ernest Hemingway, 1993. Over and over again, he was a top choice of many directors for rural American characters. He was illiterate, sharecropper, caring for a woman and a child in Tomorrow, 1972, a psychopathic Jesse James in The Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid, 1972, a good-hearted Southern lawyer in Ramblin' Rose, 1991, and a Tennessee backwoods hermit in Great Low, 2009. Perhaps his definitive country role was the wise and guerrillous Texas Ranger Gus McGray in the hit CBS TV miniseries Lonesome Dove, 1989, based on Larry McMurtry's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel about a cattle drive. It bought Mr. Duvall, later named as Honorary Ranger, many crusty cowboy roles. Unsettling by typecasting, he agreed to play Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, not ultimately one of his better roles in a TV film. In preparing for a role, Mr. Duvall spent time with cowboys, day laborers, policemen, fighter pilots, ball players, Bowery drunks, Baptist ministers, and ex-cons, scrupulously studying their rhythms of speech, their hand gestures, the twists of their personalities. He said he tried to find pockets of contradiction, shadings, to suggest multidimensional character. I hang around a guy's memories, he told another interviewer. I store up bits and pieces about him. Last resort becomes a long career. Robert Selden Duvall was born in San Diego on January 5th, 1931. He was the middle of three boys raised by their mother during their father's long absences at sea. Mr. Duvall described himself as an aimless youth without distinction in the classroom or on the playing field. He frequently indulged in mischievous behavior with his siblings. We used to put Tide in milkshakes for my mother, he told the Washington Post in 1983. His practical jokes included a penchant for mooning other actors, continued well into his adulthood. After army service, he enrolled in Principia College, a small Christian Science school, his family's faith, in Illinois. He was a social studies major on the brink of flunking out when a drama teacher remarked on his promise in several plays. His parents, pleased that he seemed to be excelling something, pushed him to a major in dramatics and then toward an acting career. It was a last resort, he said. He graduated in 1955, then attended Neighborhood Playhouse Workshop in New York, where classmates included Dustin Hoffman, Gene Hackman, and James Caan. His breakthrough came in 1957, Long Island production of Arthur Miller's drama, A View from a Bridge. The noted director, Uli Grossberg, cast Mr. Clavel in the lead role as Brooklyn John Shoreman, struggling with his attraction to his niece. Even then, he had the thing you go far as an actor and director, perfect control, but the feeling of total unpredictability. Grossmard later told the Los Angeles Times, "A lot of good actors will give you technique, precision, and character's arc, and that's important, but not that many give you the sense that this is actually what's transpiring and at the moment in front of your eyes." The one-night-only show sparked attention and proved a catalyst for my career, Mr. Duval later said, leading to offers to play menacing roles on TV and stage. He made his Broadway debut in the thriller Wait Until Dark in 1966 as a criminal who taunts a blind woman, Lee Remick, and played an ex-con in American Buffalo, 1977, David Mamet's first play to reach Broadway. Meanwhile, Mr. Duval gained a foothold in Hollywood. Pulitzer-winning playwright Horton Foote was instrumental in launching the actor's flourishing movie presence. Foote, who wrote the screenplay for To Kill a Mockingbird, had been bowled over by Mr. Duval's balance and intensity of naturalism on stage and recommended him for the part of Boo Radley. That led to memorable roles in some of the defining movies of the era. He played the pompous hypocrite Major Frank Burns in director Robert Altman's MASH, 1970, in Coppola's The Conversation, 1974, a much-admired drama of Watergate-era paranoia. He was mysteriously businessman who bankrolls a surveillance operation. Mr. Duval played a corporate hatchet man in Network 1976, a brilliant satire of broadcast journalism morphing into a ratings-driven entertainment. Mr. Duval also was top billed in director George Lucas's feature film debut, The Dystopian THX-1138, in 1971. Later his career, Mr. Duval enlivened many a big-budget mediocrity with a gruff, leathery persona on display in the Tom Cruise car racing drama Days of Thunder, 1990, the Nicolas Cage heist film Gone in 60 Seconds, 2000, and the violent action thriller Jack Reacher, 2012, also starring Cruise. Still capable of death and playing, Mr. Duval received Oscar nominations for his supporting roles in A Civil Action, 1998, playing a wily corporate attorney who duels over a settlement with John Travolta's lawyer character, and in The Judge, 2014, as a domineering small-town magistrate accused of murder who is defended by his son, Robert Downey Jr. Mr. Duval's well-paying Hollywood projects subsidized his passions. Small-budget films he wrote and directed included Angelo, My Love, 1983, about Romani people in New York, The Apostle, which was 15 years in the planning, and Assassination Tango, 2002, about a Brooklyn hitman with a weakness for sensual Argentina dance, like the character. Mr. Duval was dedicated to tango dancer. His marriage to Barbara Benjamin, actress Gail Youngs, and dancer Sharon Brophy ended in divorce. In 2004, he married Luciana Pedraz, an Argentine actress, 41 years his junior, who appeared with him in Assassination Tango. Complete information on survivors was not immediately available. Mr. Duval said he abhorred acting that called attention to itself, leveling criticism of revered leading men such as Brando, Lazy, or Olivia, too styled. An actor was at his best and most real, he said, when he could summon emotions from his own life without actorially ego. Being a leading man, no, I never dreamed of that, he told the Chicago Tribune. It's an agent's dream, not an actor's. Trump directs federal government to intervene in Potomac sewerage spill. The president said the federal government would help with an incident that poured 200 million gallons of raw sewage into the Potomac River. By Dana Hedgepedge, Carolyn Y. Johnson, and Joe Heem. President Donald Trump said Monday that federal authorities will respond to a major sewer spill that occurred 4 weeks ago in the Potomac River, which flows between Maryland, Washington, and Virginia. In a post on his social network, Truth Social, Trump said the Federal Emergency Management Agency would play a key role in response involving management, direction, and coordination to protect the Potomac. FEMA is one of the agencies affected by the current partial government shutdown. In past shutdowns, its employees have largely been required to work without pay. White House officials did not immediately respond to questions about what the federal response to the spill would entail. Trump blamed local Democratic leaders for gross mismanagement in his post, and he singled out Maryland Governor Wes Moore, D., suggesting that the governor is incapable of handling the situation. On Air Force One on Monday afternoon, en route to Washington from Mar-a-Lago, Trump again criticized Moore. I don't like the fact he did that horrible, you know, with the pipes and the Potomac. And he's not doing his job, Trump said. I'm going to have to get the federal government involved in getting it fixed because he can't fix it. Moore, who often spars with Trump, accused the president of using the Potomac as talking point and said the Environmental Protection Agency refused to participate in a major hearing about the cleanup Friday. This concludes Tuesday, February 17th, The Washington Post. This is Rita from Talking Information Center. Thank you and have a good day.